Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Gravity Leadership is a community of people seeking to live our lives in the orienting center of God's love in the midst of our post-Christian world, learning to lead like Jesus, live on mission, and make disciples. In nature, gravity is the phenomenon that brings stuff together, objects as small as atoms and quarks and as large as stars and galaxies. We believe the gravity of the Christian life is the love of God revealed in Jesus Christ. The Gravity Leadership Podcast is curated conversations on what it looks like to practically orient our lives and our leadership in the love of Christ, the gravity that holds everything together. Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. I am joined today by my co-host, co-founder, Ben Sternke.
Hello, I'm here.
And guest from last time, she was so helpful and illuminating and erudite that we decided
to
have her back. Becky Dunn is with us again.
Hi, everybody.
And today on the podcast, we have our very good friend, he used to be a bachelor, but no longer. He was one of the most eligible bachelors I knew. His name is Adam Gustin. But he's been a married man for a long time now. Right, Adam?
Yeah, as long as you've known me and longer, actually.
I just heard stories about you from before.
Point of order, yes.
my good friend Adam Gustin is going to join us today. We're going to talk about working in the church for justice, and particularly working in the church and how it relates to our leadership for racial reconciliation and socioeconomic issues and community development, etc. So, Adam, you're joining us today because this is a passion of your heart. You're in the process of writing a book about this, and you're leading out in a context with a denomination for that. So, can you give us a brief introduction of just where you are and who you are and what you're doing?
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate the opportunity to be on today. I work for the Evangelical Covenant Church. We have a lot of different priorities, but one of them is in the area of mercy and justice. We call it love, mercy, do justice. And my role is director of ministry initiatives, which basically means that I work with congregations at the local level. What does it look like to, as the church in place, embody justice along lines of race, but also community development? What does that mean to be the church, particularly among vulnerable or at-risk populations?
Great. Great. So, what's your title? Give me what's your official title?
The Director of Ministry Initiatives for Love, Mercy, Do Justice.
That's a long title, man.
It fits on two business cards if you put them side by side.
That's great. So, on this podcast, we are attempting to give people an imagination for how to live in the way of Jesus. And we've described the way of Jesus through our missional axioms. God is always present and at work. God cares about all of it more than we do. And God is so real, he's going to most fully meet us where we really are, etc. We have a long conversation today maybe about this, but my question just primarily exists in this realm. You come from, you know, you're a white dude like I am. We have another white dude, Ben Sternke.
Hey,
I just outed your race on this podcast.
I know, but, yeah. All right. It was a mystery until now.
Nobody knew. Becky, also
sort of a minority.
Sort of. Sort of.
She's not a white dude.
I'm a white woman.
White woman. Yeah. So we have four white people talking about race and justice. Ben, this was Ben's idea. Adam. Are there any hazards to that that you've discovered in your job?
Not a single one. This is the perfect arrangement.
What are you learning as someone who cares deeply about racial justice, economic justice from somebody who's coming from a place of, you know, privilege in our culture based upon your socioeconomic and your race and your gender, et cetera?
Yeah, you're right. We probably could have a number of different conversations about this, or it could go in a number of different ways. But I think that the first thing that I would say is that the number of ways that I am a liability in the work of justice or racial righteousness are probably too many to count. And the primary one, I'm convinced, is that I am blind to almost all of it all the time. Yeah. And so while there is a sense in which I think as a community, a white church community, we need to be having these conversations so that we're not always asking leaders of color to help us. That's really important for us to have these kinds of conversations. It can become really easy, really quick for it to just become like an internal feedback loop where we're actually not seeing the things that we need to see. It can be kind of dangerous.
Yeah, exactly. So what are some of the things that you're discovering and learning? You mentioned your blindness, and you're mentioning these feedback loops that we get into. But could you bring that down into sort of discrete, concrete artifacts? Like, what does that look like tangibly for you?
Yeah, I think a lot of them, I feel like a lot of them are postures that then end up manifesting themselves in real concrete ways. So for instance, when I first encountered the issues around justice, I think I was in college, and it was when, you know, Bono was making the African AIDS crisis something that evangelicals started talking about. I think that was like the first time that I really started thinking about justice. And I remember it created in me this like existential crisis. How could God let something like this happen? And so I was continually thinking about it in terms of what I, you know, like to put it maybe crassly, like it became a question of systematic theology for me. Injustice was a problem of evil conversation.
Okay.
And I remember having a conversation with a mentor of mine, and I was, you know, sort of like railing on God and my lack of faith based on it. And he said, well, you know, God has already given the world in some ways the answer to this problem, and it is the church, it's the people of God, and we're just not doing what we need to be doing. And he, you know, he just sort of outlined some of the facts related to the ways that the church is disengaged from issues around justice. And that was really enlightening for me. And as I think about it now 15 years later or whatever, I think about it a lot. Like I see that happen a lot, particularly with white Christians, is that we turn injustice into something that is abstracted outside ourselves, which feels pretty white in general. Like we want to turn it into propositional truth, or we want to turn it into a systematic theology conversation. That always keeps the issue outside of ourselves, rather than asking, where are we at fault? Where are we complicit in the injustice? And we were talking about whiteness and racial injustice and systemic issues in the United States. If white Christians are pushing the problem out and abstracting it, then we will never accurately and meaningfully be engaged in that, because we won't be able to name our own complicity in the problem. So I think that's one of the main things. Because then I think the other thing that happens then is when we notice then that injustice, if it lives outside of us, that means I don't have anything to repent of. But I'm also prone, I think as a white man, I'm also very prone to assume I have the answer for the problem. Rather than being like a monkey wrench injustice, I'm much more like the Messiah. So like, it's a very white thing to push a problem that I'm complicit in outside of myself, and then assume that I'm the person perfectly positioned to solve the issue. And so I jump in with both feet to try and like make the difference in the world. Those two things live in every white body. I'm convinced of it.
Yes. Adam, I know exactly what you're talking about, even though I don't struggle with it. And I think I know what to do about it.
Perfect.
I've developed a blog. I wrote a blog post about it. I abstracted it into an idea that lives on the internet.
Oh, man. I want to live. I mean, I think that we could end the podcast there. Cue the outro music. But you, I interrupted you to make a not very funny joke, Adam. What were you saying?
No, I think that was it. Just that to the extent that we believe we're not the problem and the answer to it, particularly when it comes to the domestic version of injustice, we're gonna get in our own way, and we will be liabilities in the work until that becomes centered in the way that we talk about it.
So here's the question that goes through my mind, Adam. I wonder if you could reflect on this with us. I think for a lot of, and I know for me, the place I live and the make of my church and all that kind of thing, I don't come into contact super regularly with issues of injustice and, you know, these kinds of things. For me, most of my interaction with these kinds of issues comes via social media, the internet. I hear about things, right? I read a news story, I hear a quote, I have this, you know, this dilemma, I guess, because I, on the one hand, I don't want to just turn a blind eye to these things. I think that's maybe could be looked at as a white thing to do, you know, like, well, you know, not in my backyard, so it doesn't affect me. But by the same token, I think there's also a trap that we can get into where we just think that if I'm, you know, retweeting the right things on social media, that I am working for justice as well. Like, what advice or what reflections do you have on that?
Wait, that's a trap?
it's a trap. it is a trap, I think, you know? Because that, again, I'm hearing you say, like, one of the tendencies is to abstract this outside, you know, into an idea. And I think social media does that, where it's like, it doesn't cost me much. You know, I might lose a few followers if I tweet the wrong thing. But what, I don't know, like, what would you say to somebody who wrestles with that, to say, like, you know, I care about this. I don't interact with it a lot in my normal life, but I want to feel like I'm doing something? Or, you know, how do I navigate that?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of things probably you could say about that. I think I'd come to two or three things. If I think the first is that if it's a context where there's not a ton of in-your-face injustice issues, or maybe there's not the diversity level that would create the constant conversation around racism or discrimination or something like that, I think one first step would be to take a longer look at the story of the place. And this is where, you know, like a holistic theology of place that gets kind of worked out in community could be really interesting. Because when you think about, for instance, the creation of the suburbs and why they were created and the kinds of life situations they were created to protect, the people that were, that they were designed to keep out, most contexts that would be sort of homogeneous in that sense would have layers of discrimination in their early story. And that suburbs and cities have a symbiotic relationship for one degree or another. And so it's difficult to live in a place like Fishers and it not intersect with the way that it means what it means to live in Indianapolis. Those are connected entities. You know, in the suburbs here in Chicago, you know, you have a lot of people who live out in the suburbs and work in the city, and so they're economically tied together. And yet, you know, 50, 60, 70 years ago, the city of Chicago, people that lived in the city made their money in the city and spent their money in the city, and so you have kind of an ecosystem that served itself.
Yeah,
you have the creation of the suburbs, and then all of a sudden you have an ecosystem that serves an outside community. And who is the community that loses in that kind of a situation? So I'll stop there. But I think the point is that place does matter, and that I think that that in the story of any community, you're going to have the opportunity to discover ways in which we're part of a story.
Yes,
and that doesn't mean that we're necessarily actively engaging in unjust practices. But I do think that it's prerequisite work. Before we say, well, there's no injustice in my community, we probably need to examine that deeply and ask those questions deeply.
Yeah. So I hear you saying that the first thing is to realize like racism, injustice doesn't live at the individual level. It doesn't just arise out of me having a bad feeling towards somebody who's not like me and then acting on it. It actually happens without me realizing it, just by the fact that, you know, I'm part of a system. Yeah. An interrelated system.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And that what is the systems are designed to produce the outcomes they produce.
Right.
And so to the extent that a system preferences a certain community or a certain group of people, it means that it's de-preferencing another community somewhere else, doing something at the expense of another. And I think that would be maybe the second thing is that, in my last pastorate in Indiana, we were in a fairly homogeneous, white, upwardly mobile community, but we didn't have to look very far to find a school system, for instance, where 90% of the kids were on free and reduced lunch. And this didn't leave our community at all. It was just, there's the school where 90% of the kids live below the poverty line or live right at it. So you have opportunity, I think, to discover those kinds of margins anywhere. They might not be the ones that are being talked about on CNN, but there are margins in any kind of community. And I think that this is the real opportunity for like a parish-oriented congregation is to sort of intentionally look for where those margins are and to, embody the way of Jesus by putting yourself there.
Great. That's great. You were going to mention a couple other things.
That's the second thing is to start to look for the margins, people who are being othered or pushed out and sort of discerning what it would look like to embody the kingdom at the margin rather than toward the margin. I don't if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And then I think a third thing could be, how would you phrase that? Learning to narrate issues of injustice within the discipleship framework of your church, in a way that sort of resists, the partisan divide. I mean, I think that's one of the hardest things is that when you're in a homogeneous community, you might tend to have distance from the actual personal aspect of injustice. If you don't have any immigrant families in your church, it might be hard to get people to see what's happening at the border right now as pressing to them and something other than a political topic to debate. And so to the extent that we begin those kinds of conversations within the sort of partisan antagonism becomes pretty difficult. But thinking about justice as an issue of discipleship rather than outreach to me means that there is a way that God sees the world and a way that God wants us to see the world. And that sometimes that's going to mean that something is just flat out wrong. and it isn't a matter of political debate. And nuance is actually a way that we sort of stiff arm what's just true.
Good. So just to recap, you said, number one, know the story of your place, because there are almost certainly systemic issues as to like, why are we so homogeneous? You know, that didn't just happen naturally. That was probably engineered somehow. Number two, what was number two?
Look for the margins.
Look for the margins. Yeah. So they may not look like what you see on the news, but they exist in your community, and you've got to get out there and look at those places because they do exist. Find out what they are for your community. And number three, find some way to narrate this into the discipleship framework of your church, where this becomes not just a partisan topic or an elective for discipleship. Like, oh yeah, some people care about justice. But this actually becomes endemic to what it means to be a disciple of Jesus, is that we think about these things, we know about them, we are involved in them. Yeah?
Yeah, I think so. Because if you think about it, many times the justice conversation gets sort of framed in the negative. This is wrong. And there is definitely a layer where that has to be the case. But I think the more you look at justice through the lens of Scripture, it's much more generative. It's much more about the shalom of God, God's wholeness, flourishing and thriving of people and communities. And so if we were to frame it in the sense that God designed us to flourish holistically, and that the story of God's redemptive and reparative work in the world finishes that way, and if it's true then that God cares about that more than I care about that, then it's possible for me to frame questions of justice around who's not experiencing the flourishing of God. Where are the communities in our local community where we're not thriving, where shalom is not taking root? And what would it look like then for us to be a part of that work in the world? So it's the same conversation in my mind, but one frame from the positive or frame from the sort of generative side. But I think all that is work that gets at that larger question.
Great. I have a question, Adam. What's a good way to originally spark people's interest in this and them even realizing this is an issue? There's so many people sitting in churches that aren't aware of it. They don't see it. So from a larger scale, these are all great ideas. How do you get people who are completely unaware of this, living in the suburbs of Indiana or wherever they are, that just don't see it? How do you get it to touch their hearts?
Well, that's a good question. You know, to be honest with you, there are days when I'm tempted to say, if watching the news doesn't touch your heart, then I don't have anything to say to you.
Yeah.
But as a pastor, you're not allowed to say that. At least
and it sometimes itself. Depends what news station you're watching as well.
Right, yeah, yeah, true. Absolutely. Absolutely. To me, it's helpful. I think about Jeremiah 29 a lot. There's a lot of urban ministry justice layers in Jeremiah 29. But the thing that I come back to a lot is that when God talks about calling Israel to seek the shalom of Babylon while they're there in exile, but that they're going to be there for three generations. But God says something interesting, that if Babylon prospers, you will prosper. We live in a world where it's totally opposite of that. We want to prosper, and we believe that if I prosper, somehow my prosperity will trickle out to the rest of society. But God frames it the other way, that if the entire community prospers, that's where I find my flourishing in that. But there's this generational vision. So like when you're watching TV and they have those financial planning commercials, and you've got this, like the old guy that's watching his grandkids like run around on his really super nice yacht, and like, this is the goal. That's the American way, but like God turns it on its head. It is a generational vision, but it's a community-wide generational vision.
Yeah.
And so to me, I think it's got to intersect there, because that impulse to want your grandkids to be in a better spot than you is I think human and full of virtue. Yeah. But what we've done is we've sort of twisted it, because we've come to view the rest of the world as opponents for a limited set of resources.
Yeah.
That everybody else gets in the way of the possibility of my grandkids flourishing. But I think if Jeremiah 29 is anything to say to us, it says that's actually really backwards. That there is the possibility of community flourishing, and that my grandkids will flourish if the community does. So I think about this a lot. Like when my kids were first starting to play baseball, and I watched some of the other coaches like lose their minds on 5-year-olds playing t-ball.
Don't believe it. Doesn't happen.
It really, that never happens down there.
No, youth sports. The people don't lose their minds ever, right? No.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I spent that whole first season just being afraid that the next year they'd get one of these like psycho coaches. So I decided to sign up to coach them only because I didn't want my kids to have like their lives ruined by a maniac.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I signed up to coach, and so like I came at it with this idea that like the world out there is the thing that's threatening my kids flourishing. And so I did this very self-protective move. But we were in this little league where like all the kids on my team, almost all the kids on my team were living in total chaos. Their lives were very different than our lives. And so they would have been kids who experienced a lot of those margins that I was talking about. And it was like this really regular thing that if I had to learn how to see that God wants for all these kids what I want for my kids and even more. And that if I sort of worked for the good of my kids at the expense of the rest of these team, these kids on the team, that they would suffer because of that. But if my goal was to see all these kids have a great summer and learn and find their gifts and, you know, learn all these things, then my boys would have that experience as well. When I think about that, that to me is where I start to in these places, because everyone in the church resonates with this idea of wanting to see their kids and their grandkids flourish. And to me, it's just connecting the dots of saying what God wants for all kids, we want to want for all kids too.
Yeah.
And that's a really easy way to get into all of this. And you can start talking about all kinds of things as an extension of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Adam, something that's really important. I want to highlight what you said. It's occurring to me as you talk about this school that, like you mentioned earlier, you worked at a church and the school had kids on like government lunches, and then you have this little league and there's kids around your kids that your impulse is to protect your kids, but then you find that their flourishing is bound up with this other kid's flourishing. One of the things that I hear you, one thing I'm inferring from what you're saying is that there really is no way to transcend this blindness or this ignorance without actually your story connecting with other people's stories.
Mm-hmm.
Like the relational importance, you know, of intersecting with somebody else who sees the world differently, who is coming from a different place that you are, and having to reckon with that either through the fact of like you're living on top of me, next to me, or I have to be with you every day and be your coach.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. And I don't think it's it's not like a curricular pursuit where we turn in the final paper and then have arrived so that we ever move past the need for those kinds of voices and influences in our lives. And I think that, you know, in one way is a great gift that I've had. Certainly the most challenging part of the last 15 years of my life, but the greatest gift is that in every place that I've been in significant relationships with leaders of color, women, people who have challenged me to see outside of sort of my narrow, privileged, preferenced story. That's not something that I ever am able to feel comfortable enough to move on. I haven't had enough voices in me, and that'll just never be the case. And I think it's because I live in a world that constantly wants to preference me, and that I am very willing to allow that to happen unless I have people helping me see not only the injustice, but the possibility of real justice, real shalom, by figuring out what it looks like to resist that. I think that one of the dangers is that when you look at like the academic work on white fragility, for instance, one of the things that they talk about with white fragility is that actually one of the more dangerous forms of white fragility is progressive white fragility. Because as you get awoken to racial justice, the white fragility tends to insulate you from feeling like you have any further to go. And I would say that as I live in the justice world that tends to be a little more progressive, I certainly experience that in my own life and see it everywhere that, white folks who are woke might be a greater liability than people who just have never been rustled out of their sleep.
Right. So, and because you're saying they might live under the illusion that I've arrived, right?
I've arrived at
wokeness, and so now, what else is there to do?
Mm-hmm. Exactly, because I don't think that being awakened to injustice does anything to mitigate the problem from the beginning that I talked about, like the abstraction and the messianic complex. Like I think we still all are going to walk through the world with that. So if I wake up to racial justice, assume I'm not part of the problem and assume I'm part of the answer, it's the same moment.
Right.
But I don't have any other voices in my life that's challenging me and helping me see what I don't see. Then there can be a lot of collateral damage there.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, Adam, that's powerful, man, and really helpful for me personally. Can we talk leadership for a second? So you mentioned this sort of knee-jerk sort of white people problem. of abstracting the issue and then assuming that they're the savior or they have the way to fix it. So how do we then inhabit these spaces? So for instance, just take this baseball team. I think the more granular we get, the more helpful we get. I think we can generalize from granular, but it's hard to get granular from generalizations. So in this baseball team, like how do you inhabit that space as a leader in a different kind of posture? You mentioned there's a posture shift that has to happen. How do you inhabit that without centering your whiteness, centering your privilege, being a savior, having it be charity, making justice sort of this service project? Like, what's tangibly different about Adam as the baseball coach now than it would have been 15 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, this is probably where we will find our way into the spot where four white folks talking about injustice could get us in trouble. But I will say this is, I'll just talk about it, I guess, from my perspective and beg the grace of those who might see better than me. But I think to use that baseball team as the right opening metaphor, I mean, I think it comes by being deciding that you're going to change the priorities, deciding that you're going to change the goals and the values structurally, and then be willing to take any sort of heat that you might get from that. So for instance, on this baseball team, we had a lot of kids who'd never played before, didn't know what hand the glove went on and had never made contact with the ball in their life. And we're doing this because, you know, in some ways it was free babysitting or something like that. And so in a world that is Little League baseball, where everybody wants to win the trophy, you have to be willing to say, we are not about winning the trophy. That success as defined by the entire league is no longer success for us. That success for us comes when Alyssa makes contact with the ball for the first time in the last game of the season. And that's the thing that we're going to celebrate because we are all in this together. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty easy to say, well, we're about player development, but also it's more fun when we win. But see, I think that takes the bait. I think that assumes the premise of the question, I guess, in society. We have to that summer be resolute in saying, nope, I don't care if we win or lose. My reaction to winning or losing is the same every time, no matter what, because all of these kids need something much different from me. Now, in re-narrating those goals, that meant that I had to deal with all the parents who didn't necessarily think the way that I thought about this. And that certainly we can have fun when we win, but losing doesn't have to not be fun. And we're, you know, sort of helping the parents see what maybe we didn't all see together. Now, this is something that I hadn't arrived at this, but I think that that's a big piece of it. So then when I think about leadership in the church and I think about these kinds of issues, I think we have to be willing to say, well, we've got to re-narrate the values and things that we're shooting for. So if the number one goal of your church is to be self-sustaining financially, and you say you want to be about justice and people at the margins, well, those goals are in conflict with each other because you can't be discernibly about the most vulnerable folks and have a financially self-sustaining church. Those things will always be in conflict with each other. In the traditional way, right? To say that out of our tithing members, we want to be self-sustaining. All we will do is continue to push the poorest folks in our community out to the margins. So as a church, then we've got to be willing to say, well, our sustainability is going to come in other ways because we want to be in a place where we can genuinely honor what people from the margins have to bring to our community. Rather than just sort of try and have it both ways. Mm-hmm. So as an example, I think that's one of the ways that gets at it.
Wow.
That's a lot to think about.
Yeah, it is.
It's really good.
I'm thinking about it right now. Can't you hear?
Very different than most church cultures that I'm familiar with.
Yeah. It was almost like the self-sufficiency, thing feels virtuous, feels good, feels right. But, you know, it's just another interesting, I guess, area of blindness.
That's because you're white, Ben.
I know. It feels virtuous, and that's what I'm, you know, that's what I'm realizing is like, okay, we've got to get creative about that.
And even winning, even doing things primarily based upon sort of economics, you know, being in the black or being in the red, and self-sufficiency as a indicator of self-value or self-worth, or even the veracity or success of what I'm doing.
Right. Yeah. How do I know I'm doing well? Well, tithes and offerings are up. You know,
we win the game. Our team has a winning record. Yeah. That's how we know we're doing well. Yeah. And so I was going to ask the corollary question, Adam, like, what do you lose on that baseball team if you don't shift the value? So if you keep the value of wins and losses dictating the success of the season, what do you not gain in that space?
Well, I think what ends up happening then is that I'm a really nice coach that all the players like, but structurally, the best players get the best spots. And by best, I mean the ones who already know how to play the game the way the game is played. They're the ones that get the best spots. And so, you know, my sons, the ones that are very close to me, we have the bag with all the catcher's gear in our trunk all the time. And so that means they get to practice with me all the time and I get to see them. And I, of course, preference them because I know them. And so they hit third and fourth in the lineup and they get to play whatever position they want. And, you know, little Alyssa gets in when she can get in. Right. And I may be equally nice to everyone. But if it's about winning, then I will position people in the spots where we will still win, which means that nothing about the structure has changed and that her contributions are discernibly valued less than, say, my son's. And we may all smile at the picture, right? And I may be able to put my arm around all the kids and all the parents may see it, but structurally nothing has changed. And I really think that that's a big piece of life in the church as well. Unless we are willing to actually say we are going to redefine what it means to be in a successful church, then we will, you know, we'll be in a stadium full of multicolored people holding hands and singing songs and then walk out and nothing structurally has changed. We may have the reputation of being nice, but we haven't addressed the issue of structures or power or access or, you know, seat at the table. None of those things actually change unless we start redefining our values and our goals.
Yeah. So can you name, go ahead, Becky, you have something?
Oh, I was just going to say, practically speaking, how receptive are churches to hearing this?
Adam?
What's been your experience, Adam?
What's the question? I didn't hear it.
Practically speaking, how receptive are churches to hearing this?
Well, I'll let you know in about 8 months. No, I think that, so the reality is not receptive in the main, because, the status quo is the status quo for a reason. And the people who stand to lose, when you disrupt the status quo are the ones who have been winning. And so it takes a leadership and discipleship culture that's willing to lose, willing to divest, in order to see the whole win. And we just, I'll say as humans, are not predisposed to making that choice. All right. The self-interested choice is the one we should make. And so it's very difficult to do that. There's a really interesting story, actually, where I work now, the story of how this came to be. This office some 20 years ago had a different name, but it was the very first time that an office dedicated to compassion and mercy and justice ministry had existed in our denomination. And the guy who had been leading it, his name was Jim, was a white guy, had been leading these kinds of ministries before and was sort of put in place as the first, you know, executive in charge of this area. He literally pulled in his, number two as an African-American man, and they switched jobs and he became his vice president and put the African-American man, in terms of, being the executive over this. It's that kind of like, I'm willing to lose, in order that we all can find the greater sense of God's justice in this. That is extraordinarily rare, right? Like I just told a story from 20 years ago, because it's extraordinarily rare to see that kind of power and structural change happen. But it's not just, that's just not a racial thing too. I mean, we want to say that we want to value and affirm women in ministry. That same choice has to be made, right? And that same choice has to be made. We can't just change a title. We have got to change the power structure in order to see and celebrate everyone that's part of our communities.
Mm-hmm. That's really good.
I want to have another follow-up podcast. Adam, are you willing to come back?
Sure.
Yeah, we'll get started on time this time, I promise.
All right, sounds but good.
I think there's a sense in which this is why I want to talk about power less from a hierarchy, less from sort of who's on top and then who's on top gets to dictate things, and now we just need a new person on top, right? I'm beginning to see how being on top of the social hierarchy has done awful work, not just for minorities and marginalized people, but for me. Like it's hard for the person on top to say, hey, you don't want to come up here to the people who aren't on the top. I mean, that's like, you know, of course you don't want to divest of that, but I'd love to have a conversation about how do we reimagine power so that there doesn't have to be an oppressed and a marginalized person. And what does Jesus have to say about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's really great. And it's a long conversation, like you say, but the one thing that I'll say at this point is that, I think you're absolutely right that structures that oppress create pain and brokenness, not only in the oppressed person, but in the oppressor themselves. And so just flipping the table to put a different person or a different group of people in that position of power, that currently existing position of power, doesn't do anything for anybody. The struggle, of course, is that there's a way to talk about power from the position of power that says, well, what we're going to do is we're going to create a flat leadership system.
Right.
But that doesn't actually address the inherent power and privilege.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So I can say to a room that might be lots of different ethnic groups and both genders represented, I could say to the room, hey, we're all equals here, but we don't live in a world where that's at all true.
No.
So we actually have to make proactive decisions to make sure that that happens. We can't just flatten it. Because if we just flatten it, the white man is still going to be in the position of de facto power.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's sort of ignoring what I bring with me to the room. So I'm with you. I don't think it's just a matter of flipping it, but I do think that there's a lot that has to go into what that looks like.
Well, it's hard. I mean, you can't do that in that kind of situation because you've had all these people that have had advantages that half the people in the room haven't, whether you are whether you're not white or not a male. So it's, in some ways, I feel like there's this generation of people that are going to kind of miss out because I believe we should promote people who are in minorities, whether that is somebody of a different color than me or a different, whether it's a woman. Mm-hmm. However, you also have the issue then of they're not as qualified. I hear that a lot. Like, they're not as qualified.
Yeah, right.
Which I understand that argument. We're all over the place. Women are getting hired or people of a who aren't white men are getting hired just because they're simply not white men. Mm. And I don't know what the answer to that is.
Yeah.
But sometimes it makes me feel like it's unfair to both people then as well. Yeah. That you're doing this.
Yeah.
And almost like we're not going to see this come about in a holistic way until a younger generation rises and everyone actually is just more equal and is trained more equal. They're mentored more equal. They're treated more equal. I mean, I know that as a woman, I've not had the same experiences a lot of men have had in leadership roles, and that not being mentored in that way.
Right.
You know, when you're not allowed to sit and have coffee alone with a man because,
right,
you know, you might accidentally end up in a hotel room or something.
Whoops.
It puts you at a disadvantage. And that's, you know, it's the same way all across the board if you're not a white male. Yeah. And so I don't know how that.
Yeah.
I'll shake down, I guess.
That's why I'd love to have another podcast where we talk maybe a little bit more specifically about some of those issues. Because I think I hear resonances of what you're talking about with, you know, you're talking about, you know, the baseball team, Adam, mm-hmm. where, you know, there has to be an adjustment of, like, hiring the most qualified candidate has to be one of many factors, right? Yeah. Rather than, well, that's the Trump factor for everything. Like, we, you know, it's like Alyssa never gets a chance to hit then. you know, yes. because she's not good enough already, mm-hmm. you know.
And why aren't they right. the most qualified candidate?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I think that there's a lot that goes into that, like who has determined what qualified means.
Right. Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And some of it may, too, get back to that question of story. When I think about my life, I could write a version of my life that would look like everything that I've done and every job I've had, I got on my own inherent right. merit and value. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But I think if I'm being honest, there's of course never been a spot or something that I've achieved or a job that I've gotten where it wasn't because I've had opportunity or a network of support right. or someone actually giving me a leg up, right? So there is no such thing as a self-made man, mm-hmm. and I certainly am not one of them. And so if that's the case, then all of these opportunities have put me in this position.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That I think white men in particular need to own that
right.
And stop sort of telling the story that we got where we got on our own.
Yeah.
And then start to ask questions about whether or not people have access to those opportunities yes. the same way that I do.
Yeah.
I think it's a big piece.
It's a big deal. Yeah, the structural systemic stuff.
So. I'm reading a book right now called I'm Still Here.
Oh yeah.
And it's Austin. I can't remember.
Austin Channing Brown.
Austin Channing Brown. Yes. And I just got to this part where she's talking about how her parents purposefully named her Austin because they knew that when she went into a job interview, people that were interviewing her would assume that she was a white man.
Wow.
And so she's gone into countless interviews. People are surprised okay. that she is a black woman. That's so something even just as simple as your name makes
yeah.
a difference.
Yeah.
And they did that on purpose because they knew
that's interesting.
It would give her a little bit of an advantage.
She'd get the interview.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, we got to wrap this up. Adam, you're writing a book about all this stuff. It's not out yet. It comes out in January. Is that right?
That's correct.
January of yeah. 2019. Does the mm-hmm. book have a name yet?
Yeah, it's called Becoming a Just Church, Cultivating Communities of God's Shalom. It really deals with these questions at the congregational level. What does it mean to become a just people? Justice isn't something we do out there. It's the kind of people yes. we become.
Yeah.
And that spills out into the world as we do it.
Very good. And who are you publishing with? Where can
that's with InterVarsity.
Okay. So in January, put it in your planners, folks, to look up Adam's book. And maybe we'll have you on another time, Adam, to talk about some of these other issues.
Yeah,
and
that'd be great.
We can talk about the book again. Really glad that you could make it to be with us. And to everybody else, I guess we'll see you next time. Okay?
Yeah, thank you, Adam.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity. It was great. Right.
Bye-bye, guys.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. If you found it helpful, please let us know by leaving a rating or review on iTunes or wherever you review podcasts. You can also email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com to ask a question or suggest a topic for future episodes. And join our online community for free at gravityleadership.com/join. You'll get our latest content delivered straight to your inbox, as well as an email most Fridays with curated links to articles we found interesting or helpful throughout the week. To join us, go to gravityleadership.com/join.
Mike Rowe here with a few thoughts on my favorite sweatshirt, a classic zip-up hoodie that used to be navy blue but has since faded to what the fashionistas call a distressed indigo. It's 13 years old, soft as a flannel bathrobe, and after a few hundred dirty jobs, demonstrably and undeniably indestructible. This is the kind of sweatshirt girlfriends like to permanently borrow, but I've held on to this one because I got it from American Giant. American Giant makes all their stuff right here in the USA, so they can control every link in their own supply chain. That matters. Because when you buy American Giant, you not only get great quality, you create jobs for people in factory towns all over the country. No pressure, but if you give a damn about the business of making things in America, you got to support the companies who are doing it right. Go to American-Giant.com/Mike to get 20% off your first order. That's American-Giant.com/Mike.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.